the kind that I think used to be called the Pantechnicon, to a halt, came round to open the door and lower the steps, and tousled my hair and patted my bum as I ascended, as adults were quite rightly allowed to do in those days without being hauled up before the courts and having their houses set fire to. The librarian, a becardiganed, multi-beaded old dear, was also apt to ruffle my hair. She often told me that I read so many books I would soon grow into one. For a child, to read books, especially in the summer, was looked on as very peculiar, and of course unhealthy, something I had always been used to being considered on account of my loathing of all forms of organized games and sports. "Have you," I asked her breathlessly, "ever heard of a play called The Importance of Being Earnest?" "Why, yes, my love, that's just up there, I think." It was far from the largest drama section you have ever seen in a library, a smattering of Shaw, Priestley and Shakespeare, but also, marvellously, the collected comedies of Oscar Wilde. She stamped the book out with that splendid springing spanking sound that will never be heard on these shores again. It had last been lent, the previous stamp showed me, in 1959. I thanked her, dismounted in a bound, flew up the lane, round the rear of the house, up the back stairs, and into my bedroom. Lady Windermere's fan, a woman of no importance, an ideal husband, the importance of being earnest. I read them all again and again and again, until a fortnight later, when I found myself once more restlessly pacing the corner of the two lanes. "Have you anything else by Oscar Wilde?" "Well, no, I aren't rightly sure." She lifted her reading glasses from the delicately linked silver chain that hung round her neck, pushed them to her nose, and came around the desk to inspect the shelves, as if for the first time. "Ah, no, there you go. The Complete Works of Oscar Wilde." This was more, so much more than I could possibly have hoped for. Once again, I flung myself on my bed and started to read. Some of the dialogues written in the Socratic style in essays like The Decay of Lying and The Critic as Artist confused me a little, and parts of The Soul of Man under Socialism were quite beyond me. The poems I frankly disliked, save for The Ballad of Reading Gaol, which seemed an odd subject for such a glamorous and flowing lord of language to have chosen. The stories for children made me weep, as they do to this day. And A Picture of Dorian Gray touched a part of me that I couldn't quite define, but disturbed and excited me very deeply indeed. De Profundis, too, I found beautiful but puzzling. I wasn't sure what the allusions to prison and shame and scandal and so on were supposed to mean. Indeed, I assumed the letter to be a work of fiction that held some allegorical meaning beyond my reach. I kept this collection for 4 weeks, and the cosily obliging librarian waived the late return penalty of sixpence when I at last brought it back to the mobile library. I asked if she had anything else by this Oscar Wilde. She pointed at the book. "If that say The Complete Works, then I should think that's The Complete Works, wouldn't you, young man?" It was hard not to see the justice of this. "Well, do you have anything about him, perhaps?" Her soft, powdered cheeks pinkened a little, and in a rather quavery voice she asked me how old I was. "Oh, I'm a very advanced reader," I assured her. Being tall and with a voice that never broke but slowly deepened, I could usually pass as older than my real age, which at this time, unless memory plays me false, had just turned 13. "Well," she fossicked about the lower shelves, and came up with a book called The Trials of Oscar Wilde by an author named H. Montgomery Hyde. The book was like a kick in the teeth, a kick in the gut, a kick in the groin, a kick most especially in the heart. After reading about the character of this brilliant, engaging, gentle, exceptionally kind, and quite remarkably gifted Irishman, to discover the truth of the sudden and calamitous third act of his life, the three trials, it is often forgotten that following the legal action he foolishly took against the Marquis of Queensberry, there were not one but two criminal trials against him, after the first ended in a deadlocked jury, the exile and the squalid and unhappy travels and subsequent penurious death in Paris, all this was almost more than I could bear. Yet it also confirmed in my deepest heart something that I had always known, that he and I shared a similar nature, as he would say, or sexuality, as we would call it today. My heart was wrenched by the story of Oscar. The mobile library was no longer enough. The only place for me now was Norwich City Library, 12 miles away. Sometimes I had the energy to bicycle, sometimes I took the daily coach that stopped at the same meeting of lanes at 6:40 every weekday morning. Before the internet and Berners-Lee's miraculous World Wide Web, the closest you came to metadata or hyperlinks were the bibliography and the index cards in the wooden drawers of a library catalogue. I started by seeing what else this Montgomery Hyde had written. The Love That Dared Not Speak Its Name was one book. The Other Love was even more astonishing. I found myself endlessly in Norwich City Library, scribbling down names from the bibliographies at the end of each non-fiction book. Bibliographies are the lists of titles and writers that the author has used as sources. And then haring to the catalogues to see if the library might hold a copy of anything related to a newly acquired lead to the world of forbidden love. Through such means, I learned about the infamous Baron Corvo, a.k.a. William Rolfe, and his eye-popping, trouser-shifting Venice letters, Norman Douglas, T.C. Worsley, Y, an anonymous gay autobiographer, Robin Morme, Angus Stewart, the scandalous Michael Davidson, Roger Perrefitte, Henri de Montalon, Jean Genet, William Burroughs, Gore Vidal, John Ricci, and dozens of others. It was the equivalent of clicking on web links, more cumbersome and time-consuming, of course, but breathlessly exciting. Along the way, as a happy accident, I acquired a kind of alternative literary education that ran in parallel to the one I was receiving at school. You cannot read Genet, or about him, without encountering the entirely heterosexual, so far as we know, Jean-Paul Sartre, and you cannot brush up against Robin Morme without making the acquaintance of Paul Bowles and the Tangier set. Burroughs leads to Denton Welch, Corvo to the Bensons, Ronald Furbank, Stephen Tennant, Harold Acton, and so on, until by fortuitous and serendipitous circumstances, fueled by inner erotic curiosity and stimulation, I found a world of artists and writers, straight and gay, who were their own reward. Suppose I had been born in the 1980s. All the vindication and support I might ever have needed to make me comfortable about my sexuality could have been found in television programmes like Queer as Folk, by the pioneering gay kisses on EastEnders and Brookside, in pride marches along the streets of London, and in the billions of pathways, savoury and unsavoury, offered by the internet. The fact that my childhood, youth and early manhood preceded all of this diversity, freedom, tolerance and openness, I of course regret to some degree. The brave new gay world would have saved me the doomed feeling I had that my life was inevitably to be one of secrecy, exile, seedy sex shops and the police courts. But I am very, very glad that the only available route to a proud acceptance and endorsement of my gay nature should have come through literature. I think I would always have loved Shakespeare, Keats, Austen, Dickens, Tennyson, Browning, Forster, Joyce, Fitzgerald, what the bluff English master of one of the private schools I attended called the big hitters. But I cannot thank my sexuality enough for giving me, in my particular case, a love of all reading and an introduction to the gay identity which offered so much more than GayTube and xhamster.com. So here I am now at Uppingham School, knowing that I was technically one of a despised and secretly special tribe, but little suspecting that the big issue in life was never going to be the gender one masturbated over. That was small potatoes. What smacked me amidships, holed me below the waterline, and sent me bubbling to the bottom of the ocean was love. Love made a wreck of me. Love, the silly word that lyric writers and pop songs endlessly overused. Love, the subject of so many plays and poems and films. Love, that soppy plotline that got in the way of a good story. Love came up and punched me so hard in the face that I've been giddy and brain-softened ever since. I'm flattened on the canvas, towel thrown in, and having barnacles affix themselves to my rotting decks on the seabed, if we're allowed to mix metaphors. The fact is, real life is sometimes so complicated that a pure unmixed metaphor would be unconvincing. and the truth about love, well, as Auden wondered. Will it come like a change in the weather? Will its greeting be courteous or rough? Will it alter my life altogether? Oh, tell me the truth about love. The third line was answered by an emphatic yes. Add together a manic and disruptive nature in the classroom, an addiction to sweets, as covered in loving, meticulous detail in the Fry Chronicles, a fear and hatred of compulsory games, absurdly replaced today by a love of almost all sport, and this new heart-pounding, soul-lacerating feeling that consumed my every waking hour, and a Stephen emerges who is simply too hot to be handled by any school teacher or parent, let alone by himself. I was finally expelled from Uppingham School in my first term in the lower sixth form, just as I was embarking on a two-year course of A-levels. I had taken all my O-levels when I was 14, a normal procedure then. If they thought you could get them, they put you in for them. I may have been academically mature, but I was as physically and emotionally mature as a newborn puppy, and so much less adorable. Why was I expelled? Some fraction of you reading this will want to know. Another, perhaps larger, will be really seething now. This isn't a book, it's a retread, they'll be shouting. On the other hand, it seems so rude to gloss over the whole episode as if expecting those in the dark to guess or spend money on a previous autobiography. So, once again, I will remind those who don't want to watch a repeat that they can change channels, mix themselves a liver and whey protein shake, knit a smartphone cosy, or simply take a nap. I was sacked from school because I had received permission from my housemaster to go to London for a meeting of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London, of which I was at the time the youngest member. I was to deliver a paper on T.S. Eliot's metrification of Sherlock Holmes's description to Dr. Watson of the life, appearance and habits of Professor Moriarty, who in Eliot's Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats becomes McCavity the Mystery Cat. The idea was to do the evening, which was on a Saturday, be free in London for Sunday and the following Monday, which was a public holiday to celebrate the Queen and Prince Philip's silver wedding, and return by the last train that day. As it is, I and my friend Joe Wood, who was not so natural a lawbreaker but loyally attended me, were suddenly gripped by cinemania. We saw Fritz the Cat, A Clockwork Orange, Cabaret, The Godfather, all of them time after time after time, as they ran and ran repeatedly on all-day programmes in the major West End cinemas. By the time we woke up from our binge, it was Wednesday. Sheepishly we returned, and wolfishly we were devoured. Joe, having no form, was rusticated until the end of term. I was shown the full red card. My parents tried another seat of learning, the Paston School, a local direct grant grammar, with the distinction of having educated the young Horatio Nelson. Its allure was lost on me, and I developed the habit of hopping off the bus that took me there in the small town of Aylsham, halfway between my house and the school in North Walsham, and spending all day and all the spare money I had managed to find in my mother's handbag on pinball, cigarettes and Fanta. Before long, the Paston had had enough of me too. For one thing, they had wanted to put me on a course of O-levels. I indignantly, and I dare say defiantly and arrogantly, declared that I had a very good set of O-levels already, and had been expelled from Uppingham while in the sixth form half a term into an A-level course. Why should I have to sink down to the fourth form again? Because we do things by age here, was the unsatisfactory reply. Or possibly they sensed that I was all show and no substance. At any rate, I was slowly turning into one of those sneering, I've had it up to here with edubludgication teenagers. Pinball and smoking were my highest ambitions. To pursue even these minor pastimes, I needed money, however, and when the Paston had hurled me out on my ear, my parents sent me as a last resort to NORCAT, the Norfolk College of Arts and Technology, in King's Lynn. Here I developed the even more expensive habit of gambling. A set of us would smoke and drink beer in a pub called the Woolpack, playing three-card brag for hours on end. I happily fell in with a group of highly literate and fascinating young eccentrics from the town. We met together to talk Baron Corvo, contribute to a strange magazine called the Failure Press, failure was deliberately misspelled in some way, devise a unique alphabet and arrange paradox parties. parties to which you could not be admitted unless you submitted an original paradox. Pretentious, you might think, but to find such a group in King's Lynn was thrilling for me. It was like finding not water in the desert, but a flask of quince, starfruit and lychee juice. Original, strange, testing, provocative. And, as we would say of almost everything we liked, highly conducive. At least Norcat let me take A-levels. But what with falling for a very lovely and smart girl from that group? Yes, I have that 10 or so percent of me that is entirely capable of being attracted to girls, feeling wholly uninspired by the academic side of life, and still burning inside with that desperate first love that had made such a mess of me at Uppingham, I was becoming a less stable, predictable, or hopeful entity. It is a terrible thing to look back and realize that one grew up in a kind of golden age, tarnished, but golden nonetheless. The 1970s are typically portrayed as grey, hopeless, hyperinflationary, riddled with failure, strikes, and sullen class warfare. Certainly, if you watch an episode of The Sweeney, it's hard to square John Thor's menacing, jaw-crunching, whiskey-slugging, cigarette-puffing, convention-defying, flying squad detective Jack Regan with the unconvincing Oxford English-accented, crossword-solving, classical music-loving, vintage Jaguar-driving, tweed-jacketed Inspector Morse who appeared a generation later. The brutal realism of the one, contrasted with the cosy nonsense of the other, is revealing. Similarly, the excellent balance of upstairs-downstairs stands up very well against the ghastly snobbery and tacked-on noblesse oblige of that horrible Abbey programme. I say this guiltily, having actor friends I like very much who play in it, and play excellently, but truth must out. Musically, the 1970s were astonishing, even for someone like me who is not especially attracted to pop or rock. You can distinguish early 1973, for example, from late 1973 in terms of both musical and fashion styles. Loons came in and bell-bottoms bowed out. Every week you could see the young Elton John, David Bowie or Mark Bolan on Top of the Pops, admittedly Gary Glitter and Jimmy Savile too, not to mention Mud, Slade, Wizard, Roxy Music, and a myriad of freakish novelty songs and eclectic mixes. Meanwhile, Led Zeppelin, The Rolling Stones, The Who, Pink Floyd, Genesis, yes, giant album artists were dominating the world. A few years later, punk exploded. All this a heartbeat away from the dissolution of the Beatles. Music, unless my ear is staggeringly dysfunctional, hasn't undergone anything like such remarkably swift, imaginative, colourful and fundamental changes of style in the 25 years between the arrival of rap and now. Bits of acid house, trance, garage and other electronic dance music seem to have coincided with hip-hop in a more or less unbroken line. A photograph of an 18-year-old in 1990s clothes looks exactly like a photograph of an 18-year-old in 21st century clothes. But that is not the point, not the point at all. We moan about the sense of entitlement the young are said to have today. I think it is nonsense. It is simply that they are aware of the actual entitlement my generation enjoyed. Despite coming from a comfortably off household, since expulsion from private school, all my education was at the expense of the state. Grants to cover living costs, tuition fees, everything. I even, while I was in debt to a bookshop at Cambridge, had the cheek to send a photocopy of their bill for the due sum of 400 or so pounds, the equivalent of well over 1,000 now, to the Norfolk and Norwich Local Education Authority. A tutor had added a paragraph to say that as a scholar and potential academic of the future, these books were necessary to me. A cheque to cover the bill was immediately sent. I tell stories like that to my godchildren and nephews, who are just emerging from their university careers burdened with debt, and I can see them wanting to punch me in the face. Hard. I left university and shared a flat with my friend and Cambridge lover Kim in Chelsea, and life seemed infinitely interesting and straightforward. For the emerging graduate today, there seems to be little on offer but a McJob, endless unpaid internships, only then if you know the right people, and a first rung on the property ladder that is higher and less attainable than the middle rung was in my early days. But wait a minute, you've made me leap ahead of myself again. So, Norcat, three-card brag, beer, a girl, absolutely no interest in the curriculum, and a disappearance. My memory cannot quite summon up the absolute circumstances of the first great escape. I was 17, it was 1974, I think I had agreed to go to some kind of musical festival and meet up with my friend Joe Wood. To cut a long, well, it's fairly long in Moab is my washpot story short, some credit cards fell into my possession, which is to say I stole them. The short arm of the law had been reaching out feebly for 3 months or so before I was finally apprehended at the Hotel Wiltshire in Swindon, which stood, conveniently, absolutely opposite the police station. I refused to give my name. My poor old mother and father had been through enough, surely. A sly officer, unbeknownst to me, had been going through my luggage in another room, returning and slowly whispering names that had been written on the fly leaves of the books I had been lugging around with me during my adventures. A lot of them had been stolen from libraries, bookshops, or friends' shelves, of course, and had all kinds of names scrawled on their title pages. Eventually, as I was being questioned by the detective sergeant in the interview room, I heard, "Stephen Fry," being said in a low voice behind me. I had swung round and answered, "Yes," before I was aware of the trap I had fallen into. I was, of course, on a missing persons list, and it was not long before my parents had sorted out a solicitor, my godmother's husband, who lived not far away. The game was up and the goose cooked. Some months of custody followed in the delightfully named Pucklechurch Prison. I had declined bail, not that I think my parents would have offered it anyway, and stayed at Pucklechurch for 2 weeks before another magistrate's appearance in Swindon, at which I was expected to plead. I announced my unquestionable guilt and was sent back on remand while the police took an embarrassingly long time to collect and assimilate the paperwork from the 7 counties in which I had fraudulently used the credit cards. Back inside now as a con, as opposed to a non-con, the colour of my uniform changed and I was set to work. The time passed easily and pleasantly enough. I had spent 14 years in the private school system, for heaven's sake. This was nothing. Other inmates at this young offenders institution, all tougher and mostly older than me, sobbed themselves to sleep. They had never spent a night away from home before. At my trial, a dear friend of my parents, the imposing Sir Oliver Popplewell, then a noted QC, now a retired judge, represented me. I had worried that his distinguished name and reputation might rile the magistrates. A metropolitan sledgehammer sent to crack a provincial nut could seem offensive to their amour propre. I was also concerned that they might have little patience with one who, unlike most young offenders, had been given every opportunity and simply pissed his good fortune against the wall each time. I was guiltily stricken myself by the obvious difference in the life chances, as we would say now, of most of my luckless fellows back at Pucklechurch, who had been born into backgrounds of poverty, ignorance, squalor and abuse. The magisterial bench, however, concluded that since I had a solid family background, and perhaps came from the same class as them, I crimson at the thought, there was no need for a prison sentence, which would in those days, and at my age, have taken the form of Home Secretary Roy Jenkins's short, sharp shock, the notorious detention centre, which was all the rage at the time. I had been dreading this. Fellow cons at Pucklechurch told me it was all about running around and gym and weights and eating standing up and running about again like someone in Olympic training. D.C. provided the world with marvellously fit villains, ideal candidates for posts like nightclub bouncers and drug dealers' debt enforcers. Fortunately for me, taking into account the months I had already served, plus the other possible reasons I've indicated, I found myself sentenced to 2 years' probation in the care of my parents. We move then from the image of the wretch lying on the stone flags of the prison cell, shadows of the prison bars cast across his sobbing frame, rats squeaking, gibbering and weeing in the corner, we move from this unhappy and wholly inaccurate picture to the solemn silence of the journey home from Swindon Magistrates Court, father's stern face at the wheel, jaw tightly clamped and eyes sternly on the road ahead. I seem to be sketching the biography of a Cambridge spy, a whole genre of literature to itself, factual and fictional. But whenever Kim Philby or Guy Burgess and their circle are written about, or, spoiler averted, the mole in Le Carré's Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, for example, there is repeated, to the point of cliché, emphasis on how withdrawal of the parental presence at an early age, the very nature of an old-fashioned classical English education given to a certain kind of person equipped with charm, intelligence, duplicity, guile. I was always called Sly Fry from my earliest memories of my very first schools, who had an almost pathological need to prove himself, to belong, could provide all the ingredients of a 5-star, 24-carat traitor and spy. I was and am neither, of course, but had I been at Cambridge in the low, donnest decade of the 1930s, instead of at the beginning of Thatcherism, between the winter of discontent and the Falklands War, essentially, then perhaps I would have been drawn into the Ring of Five and made it a Ring of Six. I doubt it. I'm not sure that the SIS, or MI6 as it's usually called these days, the most exclusive club there ever was in Great Britain, would have taken a Jew. Victor Rothschild came the closest, being a Cambridge apostle, like Burgess and Blunt, but even he, glamorous first-class cricketer, decorated war hero, and Bugatti-riding adventurer that he was MI5, not 6. Some people still believe that Rothschild was the fifth man who closed the circle. We will probably never know. But there was a world of difference between the two services. 6 was pucker. 5, much less so. I'm sure that's not true today, but what is true today is that I possess so many of the similar qualities, right down to a love of cricket, claret and clubland. An upbringing that might under different circumstances have been used for a complex secret betrayal of my tribe became instead a simple public mockery of it, in Latin, my first piece of proper writing, followed by Cambridge Footlights sketches, and, in the outside world, Blackadder, Fry and Laurie, and so on. Like the satire of the 1930s Berlin cabarets that, as Peter Cook observed, did so very much to prevent the rise of Adolf Hitler, the satire in A Bit of Fry and Laurie, such as it was, privatization, obsession with the free market and so forth, had the force and effectiveness of a kitten armed with a rubber bayonet. But we never expected anything else. We probably didn't imagine, however, that old Etonians would still be ruling the country a quarter of a century later, or indeed that they would be ruling the American TV and movie box office in the form of Damian Lewis, Dominic West, Tom Hiddleston, Eddie Redmayne, and my colleague Hugh himself. Male writers in Britain between the wars, as Martin Green brilliantly observed in Children of the Sun, could be divided into two classes. Those that went to Eton and wished they hadn't, like George Orwell, and those that hadn't and wished they had, like Evelyn Waugh. I certainly cannot convincingly deny that I fall into that second category. The great advantage of an Oxbridge education is not some mafia that pushes you up the ladder as soon as you leave, nor is it in the education and living standards that you enjoy at either university. The real advantage is that you never have to deal with the fact that you didn't go there. Many genuinely never wanted to. Many brush it all off with a, yeah, I could have gone, but the course at Warwick was so much better. Others simmer in rage at the number of us in comedy, television, the law, and all the other establishment trades. As would I, had I not got in. So it is with Eton. It would have been nice to have gone there, but on the other hand, I would probably have been expelled even earlier, and who knows what criminal abominations I would have committed with an OE tie and that spy-like, deceitful manner. Where were we? Travelling with my parents in a silent journey from Pucklechurch Prison back home to Norfolk. The 12 months between 1976 and 1977 followed. My first ever year of self-control, possibly my first and only year of self-control. Every day I worked on the one-year course of A-levels that I had managed to persuade Norwich City College to allow me to sit for. Aside from the syllabus, I read every Shakespeare play, writing synopses and notes on each character and scene. I devoured Chaucer, Milton, Spenser, Dryden, Pope, and all the literary giants that I supposed I would have to be expert in before Cambridge would even look at me. I read Ulysses for the first time with the help of a reading companion written by Anthony Burgess. I worked part-time in a department store in Norwich. I didn't steal or transgress. I was, it must be said, quite extraordinarily focused, sober, clean, and concentrated. Fortune favoured me, and I won a scholarship to Queen's College to read English literature. If you have read the Fry Chronicles, you shouldn't be here. You should still be descaling the rabbit or treadmilling in the gym to the varied stylings of Jack and Meg White. You already know all of this. I shall steam through for the others, and you'll find out where to pick up from where I last left off. I performed in lots of plays when I got to Cambridge. I fell in love with and shared rooms with a brilliant classicist and chess player, and more importantly, a wonderful person called Kim, as in Philby. I produced articles for university magazines. I wrote the aforementioned play Latin or Tobacco and Boys, which was performed at Cambridge and then taken to the Edinburgh Festival. This led to my meeting a tall fellow with a red flush to each cheek and a rather endearing way of saying, "Hello." He was James Hugh Callum Laurie, a name which can be convincingly expressed 16 ways. "Hi, I'm Callum Laurie Hugh James." "Laurie James Hugh Callum, at your service." "James Laurie Callum Hugh, how may I help?" etc. So many permutations, but he chose to call himself Hugh Laurie, which is how the little world of Cambridge then knew him, and how the wider world of the, wider world now knows him. Together with friends Emma Thompson, Tony Slattery, Paul Shearer and Penny Dwyer, we put on a show in our last year. It won a new award called the Perrier Prize, which resulted in us going to perform our show in London, then Australia, before coming back to record it for the BBC. This is the linear bit, and dull even if you haven't read it before. Kim and I shared a flat in Chelsea, while Hugh, Emma, Paul and I started to do a show for Granada Television in Manchester. We were, as it were, boy-banded together with Ben Elton, Siobhan Redmond and Robbie Coltrane to create a new sketch comedy troupe. The resultant show, Alfresco, was not much of a success, but we liked each other's company and new opportunities arose. Kim and I drifted apart, but are still the warmest and best of friends. My 15 years of so-called celibacy began. Work started to come in the form of newspaper and magazine articles, a West End play, a stage run of Alan Bennett's 40 Years On, and then Blackadder 2. Noel Gay's musical comedy Me and My Girl came next. I worked on the book, in other words, the story, dialogue, and some of the lyrics. The Sun Has Got His Hat On was a charming number from Noel Gay's back catalogue, and the director Mike Ockrent and I managed to make it a suitable opener for the second half of the show. The verse, "He's been roasting niggers out in Timbuktu, now he's coming back to do the same to you," needed a little tweak, one could not but feel. With pulsating lyrical talent, Gilbertian wit and astounding geographical, agrarian and botanical understanding, the verse now became, under my magical weaving fingers, "He's been roasting peanuts out in Timbuktu, now he's coming back to do the same to you." Nobody seemed to notice. No letters from outraged Malians denying that they had ever roasted a single peanut, not even in fun. No death threats from the Guild of Professional Peanut Roasters of Atlanta, Georgia. A footnote. Since writing this passage, some poor sod of a local radio DJ was forced into resignation for playing an old recording of the song. Oh, lorks. End of footnote. But the show was a success in the West End and then on Broadway. It made me money. I went mad buying classic cars, a country house, all kinds of things. I filled every day with writing, book reviews for the now-deceased Listener magazine, general articles for magazines like Arena, and radio pieces for any number of programmes hosted by Ned Sherrin. I became friends with Douglas Adams and began a lifelong love affair with all things to do with computing and the digital world. In 1986, sharing a house with Hugh and others, just having finished recording a series of Blackadder 2, I was offered by an actor who, for obvious reasons, shall remain nameless, a line of the illegal stimulant cocaine. Right. All those who feel they absorbed Moab Is My Washpot and the Fry Chronicles can come back in now. You will know from the latter that I seem to have been born with a propensity to become addicted to things beginning with C. Sugar, C12H22O11, in the form of candy, confectionery and chocolates. Cigarettes, credit cards, other people's to begin with, comedy, Cambridge, classic cars, clubs, and so on. But cocaine, oh dear, this has to be played delicately. If I go on about it too much, it will sound like repellent braggadocio. Wow, what a wild, crazy head this guy Steve-O is, taking blow like a crazy rock star. Cool. If I drown myself in pity, it's no better.
I was in the grip of a disease, and the name of that disease was addiction.
There's something po-faced, self-pitying and sanctimonious about that, true interpretation as many would insist that it is. We have heard it all before, in short-form magazine articles, in long, tearful confessionals. It is yesterday's news, kind of. But it was 15 years of my life, so it would be wrong of me at least not to, as it were, give you a sniff of the coke years. Moral or medical? The lineup. Buckingham Palace, Windsor Castle, Sandringham House, Clarence House, the House of Lords, the House of Commons, the Ritz, the Savoy, Claridge's, the Dorchester, the Berkeley, the Connaught, the Grosvenor House, White's Club, Brooks's Club, Boodle's Club, the Carlton Club, the United Oxford and Cambridge Club, the East India Devonshire Sports and Public Schools Club, the Naval and Military Club, the Reform Club, the Travellers Club, the Army and Navy Club, the RAC Club, the RAF Club, the Beefsteak Club, the Garrick, the Savile, the Arts Club, the Chelsea Arts, the Savage Club, the Soho House, Annabelle's, the Groucho Club, BBC Television Centre, Fortnum and Mason, ITV HQ, the London Studios, LWT, Shepperton Studios, Pinewood Studios, Elstree Studios, the Daily Telegraph Office, the Times Office, Spectator Offices, the Listener Offices, the Tatler, Vogue House, Vanity Fair.
I take this opportunity to apologise unreservedly to the owners, managers or representatives of the noble and ignoble premises above, and to the hundreds of private homes, offices, car dashboards, tables, mantelpieces and available polished surfaces that could so easily have been added to this list of shame. You may wish to have me struck off, banned, blackballed, or in any other way punished for past crimes. Surely now is the time to reach for the phone, the police or the club secretary. There is no getting away from it. I am confessing to having broken the law and consumed in public places Class A sanctioned drugs. I have brought, you might say, gorgeous palaces, noble properties, and elegant, honest establishments into squalid disrepute. That was then, this is now. Yet some of you will be reading this in horror, not because you are easily shocked, but because you thought better of me than this. You might have children who will read of my pathetic exploits, and you fear that they will take them as permission or encouragement to imitate the chopping out of that long line of cocaine that stretched from 1988 to 2003. Oh, Stephen, how could you? Such weakness, such feeble-mindedness, such self-indulgence, such an insult to the efficient and admirable brain with which nature graced you, and the warm and loving home in which your parents brought you up with such care. This is where it all gets damnably difficult. We come to choosing between what we might call the addiction approach and the personal responsibility approach. There are those, there will always be those, who simply do not buy this addiction concept. Most especially they repudiate the premise that addiction is a disease, one that grips you as permanently and assuredly as any chronic affliction, such as diabetes or asthma. They only see weakness, lack of grit, absence of willpower, and feeble, self-justifying excuses. They hear, most especially, figures in the public eye talking of pressure and stress, and they want to puke up. Here are rich, overpaid, overpraised, overpampered, overindulged celebrities who scrabble and snuffle and snort like rootling truffle pigs at the first bump of naughty powder they are offered, and then, after years of careless abuse, when their septum finally surrenders, or their mind turns so paranoid on them that they lose their only true friends, they bleat, "But I've got a disease! I'm an addictive personality! Help!"
I'm painting it as blackly as I can, yet I know some of you will see the foregoing as the correct, or at least as a convincing analysis. Addicts are looked at with the same wrinkled-nosed disgust that is directed at the morbidly obese waddling through Target and Walmart stores in the Midwest states of America. Those poor clams can at least claim indigence and ignorance as the root cause of their addiction to the high-fructose corn syrup, ice cream and corn dogs that are slowly killing them. Does a rock star, city whiz kid, actor, journalistic feature writer, best-selling novelist or comedian have the same excuse? In the opposite corner, there is the straightforward reverse of this pitiless verdict. It argues that addiction is indeed a condition, often inherited or congenital, and that the only way to defeat it, even if it is not a real disease, is to treat it as if it is. I can quite see how one view speaks to the contempt, envy, resentment, scorn, and impatience many in the modern world have for what is so revoltingly called, and yet so revoltingly is, celeb culture. A spoiled minority, to which I find myself belonging willy-nilly, footnote, in the real sense of willy-nilly, not in the sense of harum-scarum or all over the place, end of footnote, seem to be encouraged to believe their views on everything from politics, art, religion, and society are more valid than that of every man or woman. Oh, how we so modestly and smilingly lord it over the rest of society. Unto us is given more than we need by way of freebies, attention, and opportunity, while ordinary, real people struggle with the daily round, unattended to, unheard, bulldozered or at least elbowed aside by a brutish, shallow culture which values fame even above money. I have been fairly well known in my own country for a quarter of a century, and beyond, in Russia, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia for perhaps 15. My books have been translated into dozens of languages, but mostly I find when wandering in Eastern Europe or South America that I am taken for a strangely morphed compound of Jeremy Clarkson and James May from BBC Television's Top Gear. Something to do with being a tall, fleshy Englishman with odd hair who rings a faint bell in the eye of the average Bulgarian or Bolivian, if bells can be rung in eyes, that is. I remember a marvellous line of Anthony Burgess's when he reviewed in, I think, The Observer, William Goldman's peerless Adventures in the Screen Trade. Burgess used the phrase of film stars, those irrelevantly endowed with adventitious photogeneity, or it may perhaps have been those adventitiously endowed with irrelevant photogeneity. It so happened that I got to know William Goldman well in the early to mid-1990s, when John Cleese, in a breathtaking act of generosity, chartered a boat for about 30 to go up the Nile. All we guests had to do was turn up at the Cleesery in London, and the rest was taken care of. Carriage to the airport, flights, laundry, food, sightseeing, informative evening lectures, everything was looked after for us on the floating carriages that glided up from Cairo to the Aswan Dam. One afternoon comes back very clearly to me. We were shading ourselves in the shadow of an ancient pylon in Luxor, while our tour guide spoke of hieroglyphs and higher things. I asked Bill a few questions that I'd been too shy to previously. He was hero enough for having written Adventures in the Screen Trade, and earlier The Season, a still perfectly relevant and never less than insanely readable summation of 1 year in the life of Broadway. But Goldman was the screenwriter who wrote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, All the President's Men, Marathon Man, and The Princess Bride, and was, even then, chewing over whether he would accept the offer from Rob Reiner and Castle Rock to adapt Stephen King's Misery. Unforgivably gauche as it seems, I found my mouth forming the shy sentence, what's Robert Redford really like? Well, said Bill, tell me what you would be like if for 25 years you had never heard the word no. Which is as good an answer as could be given. It is far from necessary and sufficient not to have heard the word no for decades to become a brat, or spoiled or impossible to deal with, but it goes a long way to explaining some of the more painful characteristics of those who are called stars. It's rather like the argument used to defend those brought up in poverty and abuse, however. It fails to explain those many who, under the same intolerable, horrific circumstances, do not become members of gangs or crack-smoking thugs who could remorselessly beat an old man to death for asking them to keep the noise down. There are those who have endured childhoods we can't even imagine, who go on to university and lives of fulfillment, kindness, and familial bliss. Similarly, there are long-established stars, Tom Hanks, to pull a random name out of the starry sorting hat, who are as kind, self-deprecating, professional, unspoiled, and modest as it is possible to be. So we return to drugs. How can I explain the extraordinary waste of time and money that went into my 15-year habit? Tens, if not hundreds of thousands of pounds, and as many hours, sniffing, snorting, and tooting away time that could have been employed in writing, performing, thinking, exercising, living. I can't begin to explain it, but I can at least attempt to describe it. The early days. The first effect of cocaine is nothing. You don't get the huge, whooping, rushing high that is said to be the reward of heroin or of crystal meth and crack. I haven't tried any of those because I'm a squeamish wimp. Perhaps this denies me any credit as a true addict. Friends like Sebastian Horsley and Russell Brand, the late Philip Seymour Hoffman and all those rock stars of the 1970s who were unafraid to put a flame under a spoon, suck the juice into a syringe, tighten a tie around their biceps with their teeth, pump their fists and tap with two fingers until they found an available vein, whether it be, once the more available ones had hardened into uselessness, a vein in their eyeball or their penis, then plunge the plunger. They were surely the true addicts. I got the word squeamish from an article I read by Aaron Sorkin, the screenwriting phenomenon who gave the world A Few Good Men, The West Wing, The Social Network, and Newsroom. He was taking a break in rehearsals with Philip Seymour Hoffman, and as an ex-coke fiend, was saying to him that he'd always been too squeamish to inject himself, otherwise he supposed he'd have been a junkie. "Stay squeamish," was Hoffman's typically curt reply. It wasn't too long after that that he himself was dead. 23 years clean, and then one backslide, and it was all over. It's rather like nuclear weaponry. You can never say it is safe, because it has only been safe up until now. It needs to be safe for all time. One moment of not being safe, and the whole game is up. So, back now in London in 1986 for my first experience of taking coke. I nervously watch my friend take out a folded wrap of paper, open it, and shake out a heap of granular white powder onto a metal tray on the table beside him. He takes out her credit card, and with its edge chops gently until the powder is as fine-grained as he can make it. He uses the edge to sweep this pile into 5 equal lines, rolls up a £10 note, bends down, applies the end of the tube to one nostril and the other end to the first line, and with a sharp snort sucks in half of it. He takes the remaining half of his line up the other nostril and then passes me the rolled-up tube. With as much nonchalance as I can muster, I reproduce his actions. My hand is trembling a little, and I am more than a little anxious not to imitate Woody Allen's notorious sneeze in Annie Hall. My bent nose has gifted me a deviated septum, which means that it is uncommon for both nostrils to be in full working order at the same time. I force as much suction as I can on my line with the weak left nostril, and nothing moves. Embarrassed, I take the whole line up my clear right nostril with one huge snort. The powder hits the back of my throat and my eyes sting a little. The other three, also neophytes at this ceremony, take their turns. I sit back, expecting hallucinations, a trance, bliss, euphoria, ecstasy, something. Our host, as is his right, licks his forefinger and sweeps up the residue of powder, pushing it round his gums. Says one of our number, braver than me, "What are we supposed to feel?"
You get a bit of a buzz.
The expert claps his hands together and exhales loudly.
And you feel just good. That's what's so great about coke. It's kind of subtle.
Up until this time, the only illegal drug I had ever tried had been dope, which I had been rather ashamed of strongly disliking. Cannabis, even the milder versions of grass and resin available back then, before the age of skunk and buds, was certainly not subtle, neither in effect nor in after-effect. In 1982, I had once vomited all over, around, above and below the lavatory of a friend's house, only a few months after coming back from our footlights tour of Australia. I can't remember any discernible pleasure at any stage, and had more or less forsworn the weed. Most people have a drug that suits them, whether it is nicotine, not much of a behavioural modifier, coffee, cannabis, alcohol, ketamine, crystal meth, crack, opium, heroin, speed, MDMA ecstasy. I had decided early on that cannabis was not for me, but I hadn't for one second considered replacing it with another one. Sitting back now and inspecting the effect of the cocaine, I have to confess to noticing finally a benevolent stimulation. I observe, too, that we are all inclined to talk a little more, mostly over each other without listening, a feature I will soon come to recognise very clearly. A brief history of blow. Cocaine, if you call it blow, you sound hipper and cooler, as most people know, derives from the coca plant, indigenous to South America, principally Colombia, Peru and Bolivia. The leaves of the plant are freely and legally available in those countries to chew or to make into a tea known as a mate, and are said to help humans cope with the fatigue and altitude sickness associated with the high Andes. Ingestion of these leaves or infusions doesn't impart a fraction of any of the euphoria or stimulation associated with cocaine, but they are said to be rich in all kinds of vitamins, minerals, and fibre. When I was in South America in my puffing, wheezing, cigarette-smoking days, locals there encouraged me to chew the leaves with lime or to add lime juice to the mate in order to speed the very mild effect of coca and help me with the exhausting altitude. I suppose the process of adding lime is a gesture towards the acid base extraction which turns coca into cocaine, the Class A scheduled drug, the billion-dollar industry, the working class, media class, rural and urban community must-have weekend companion that has been growing and growing in popularity since the 1970s and still shows no sign of declining. A chief constable told me not long ago that it's easier to score cocaine in a market town in East Anglia than it is in Soho Square. It's Lombard Street to a China orange that there is more coke consumed on Friday and Saturday nights in Doncaster than in Chelsea. Footnote. That's a once common phrase that no one seems to know anymore, but it is worth looking up. End of footnote. No one can call the substance cheap, but it has held its price pretty steadily over the past decade or so, and it is now far from the preserve of the members of trendy, as the word then was, Soho or Mayfair private clubs. It was in the 19th century that the breakthroughs were made that turned this harmless, utterly non-addictive Andean bushleaf into cocaine. Ene is a suffix chemists give to alkaloids. Coffee's alkaloid is caffeine. Atropa belladonna, the deadly nightshade's alkaloid, is atropine, and so on. Heroin, on the other hand, was so called by the Bayer Company of Germany, who gave us aspirin, because it was thought to confer heroic properties on the user. No less a figure than Sigmund Freud was one of the first major medical people to write on the properties of cocaine, which was a rara avis in the 19th century, inasmuch as most major drugs were narcotics, usually derived from the poppy family. Morphine, opium, codeine, and Queen Victoria's favourite tipple, laudanum, which is morphine and alcohol combined. Blissikins, as Nancy Mitford used to say. Freud's book, Über Coca, contains some fascinating insights into the effect of this new drug on himself and his patients stroke volunteers stroke kidnapped tramps. As he wrote,
"It seems probable, in the light of reports which I shall refer to later, that coca, if used protractedly but in moderation, is not detrimental to the body. von Anrep treated animals for 30 days with moderate doses of cocaine and detected no detrimental effects on their bodily functions. It seems to me noteworthy, and I discovered this in myself and in other observers who are capable of judging such things, that a first dose or even repeated doses of coca produce no compulsive desire to use the stimulant further. On the contrary, one feels a certain unmotivated aversion to the substance.
As if, and I wish.
The psychic effect of cocainum muriaticum in doses of 0.05 to 0.10 grams consists of exhilaration and lasting euphoria, which does not differ in any way from the normal euphoria of a healthy person. The feeling of excitement which accompanies stimulus by alcohol is completely lacking. The characteristic urge for immediate activity which alcohol produces is also absent. One senses an increase of self-control and feels more vigorous and more capable of work. On the other hand, if one works, one misses that heightening of the mental powers which alcohol, tea, or coffee induce. One is simply normal and soon finds it difficult to believe that one is under the influence of any drug at all.
Freud drank while he worked? Oh, well, that explains everything. Just to repeat.
It seems probable, in the light of reports, which I shall refer to later, that coca, if used protractedly but in moderation, is not detrimental to the body.
We'll ignore the happy-sounding sudden cardiac death that today's doctors and rehab clinicians like to harp on about with what I can only call tactless relish.
Coca is a far more potent and far less harmful stimulant than alcohol, and its widespread utilization is hindered at present only by its high cost.
The cost issue is still true, I suspect, and there are certainly many, many more deaths from alcohol in the world than from cocaine, even taking into account the wider use. Death from sustained cocaine ingestion is, I think, moderately rare, but certainly not unheard of.
Long-term use of coca is further strongly recommended and allegedly has been tried with success in all diseases which involve degeneration of the tissues, such as anemia, phthisis, long-lasting febrile diseases, etc., and also during recovery from such diseases. The natives of South America, who represented their goddess of love with coca leaves in her hand, did not doubt the stimulative effect of coca on the genitalia.
Ask any seasoned cokehead, certainly a male one, and they will probably agree with those lines of the porter in Macbeth, who is discoursing here about alcohol, but may as well be referring to Charlie. Lechery, sir, it provokes and unprovokes. It provokes the desire, but it takes away the performance. Therefore, much drink may be said to be an equivocator with lechery. It makes him, and it mars him. It sets him on, and it takes him off. It persuades him, and disheartens him. Makes him stand to, and not stand to. In conclusion, equivocates him in a sleep, and giving him the lie, leaves him. Save that cocaine doesn't equivocate one in a sleep so much as leave one wide-eyed and drippy-nosed for hours upon end, staring at the ceiling and making promises for the morrow that one knows one will not keep.
Mantegazza confirms that the coqueros sustain a high degree of potency right into old age. He even reports cases of the restoration of potency and the disappearance of functional weaknesses following the use of coca, although he does not believe that coca would produce such an effect in all individuals. Marvaux emphatically supports the view that coca has a stimulative effect. Other writers strongly recommend coca as a remedy for occasional functional weaknesses and temporary exhaustion. And Bentley reports on a case of this type in which coca was responsible for the cure. Among the persons to whom I have given coca, three reported violent sexual excitement, which they unhesitatingly attributed to the coca. A young writer who was enabled by treatment with coca to resume his work after a longish illness gave up using the drug because of the undesirable secondary effects which it had on him.
So, one patient became so embarrassed by the increased libido of the drug that he discontinued it. undesirable secondary effects indeed. A Viagra? A workhorse? A cure for numerous debilitating ailments? Less dangerous or mind-altering than alcohol? Cocaine was welcomed by the late 19th century, and, as is well known, gave the drink Coca-Cola the first half of its name, though the company dropped it from its list of ingredients in 1929. It was available everywhere legally in pastille, pill or potion form as a tonic, an often self-contradictory treatment, being most efficacious in the cure of constipation and magically helpful too for the firming of loose or watery stools. It aided concentration and work rate, it cheered melancholy, and in smaller doses was remarkably effective in the calming of recalcitrant children. This was all during a period known as the Great Binge, roughly designated by social historians as 1870 to 1914, after which the First World War came and spoiled everything. Almost at the sound of the first martial trumpet, beer was weakened, licensing hours were decreased, and in 1915 the French banned absinthe, the poster child of the Great Binge. In between, during the binge itself, however, everything was on sale at your local chemist or drugstore over the counter, no questions asked. Fortnum & Mason, the elegant and grand grocer's royal of St. James's, sold tasteful hampers, which included silver boxes containing syringes and etui for doting parents to send heroin and cocaine to their sons in the South African War and early years of the Great War. Indeed, Benzedrine, the trade name of a kind of amphetamine or speed, was supplied to commandos throughout the Second World War as part of their usual rations. In the Ian Fleming novels, James Bond is hardly ever off the stuff. It was just my luck to be born into an era when virtually anything exciting, beguiling, enchanting, naughty and nice was furiously illegal. Those comedians and actors a generation above me who were worried about their weight would regularly go to their doctors and be prescribed as many bennies as they wanted. Generally speaking, anything that speeds up and stimulates your metabolism will suppress your appetite. Downers like cannabis produce, as is well known, that undignified state known as the munchies. Groups of young men and women invading a 24-hour petrol station, loading up on Mars bars, Doritos, and great basketfuls of junk food are as clear a statement of an evening of passing joints around as you could get. Maybe it is the very illegality of cocaine that drew me to consider becoming a user. Perhaps an echo of Sherlock Holmes and his 7% solution resonated in the back of my mind. Perhaps my sexuality, or even my Jewishness, had always made me believe deep down that I would never be normal, that I was forever to be an outsider, a transgressor. Nowadays, there is a war of catch-up going on, a running war between the drug enforcement agencies and the enterprising chemists out in the world. Change a molecule here and a molecule there, and you've got yourself a legal high, some kind of pill advertised as not for human consumption, but for promoting healthy plant leaf shine, which will send you completely wild for about a day and a half, which is probably overdoing it if you have a schedule like mine. Here is a truth so obvious that people fail to notice it. Precisely the same substances may, in fact usually do, have entirely different effects on different people. We see this clearly with allergies. Person A can down a bag of peanuts in one, and then, with a satisfied eructation, ask for more, while person B is on the floor choking to death with anaphylaxis because he took a bite out of an apple that grew on a tree near a factory which 10 years previously used nuts in its food processing plant. We're used to it with alcohol, too. We can sit at a table and match a friend glass for glass until that moment, that ghastly moment, mortifying for all, when the friend's eyes will snap down like shutters, he or she will start arguing with the waiters, they will start to repeat themselves, get spoiling for a fight, and generally become a foul and unspeakable embarrassment. Everyone is anxious to be as far away from as possible. They will have had exactly, to the 16th of an ounce, the same amount of alcohol in their body as you have, yet you are capable of walking in a straight line, reciting Ozymandias, doing the crossword, and drinking another 4 glasses without feeling anything more than a little merry. The number of times I have had to tell friends of mine who have had trouble with the bottle that they just must face up to the fact that they are, unfair as it seems, to all intents and purposes allergic to it. You can't even make a rule out of body size. I've had huge friends who just can't take a drink, and have known dainty girls who can drink continuously without showing any sign of instability, aggression, or wobble. I am very lucky, or perhaps unlucky, in that I have a high tolerance for alcohol myself. Sometimes I've been known to mix it with an injudicious pill and found myself in bed the next morning without the faintest recollection of how I got there or how the whole evening panned out. Another characteristic that I must be really clear and straightforward about is that I hate parties. I absolutely detest them. I don't think I have ever liked a person as much as I have hated a party. The moment I'm there, I want to leave. I discount meals around a dinner table in a private house or restaurant, but parties with music, with people standing up, parties with music, parties with buffets or canapé waiters, parties with music, bring-a-bottle parties, parties with music, poolside parties. Did I mention music? There's a famous speech in Evelyn Waugh's novel Vile Bodies, which I lifted whole for a screen adaptation I made in about 2002.